time for us to end this hierarchy of who has the right to live, who deserves not to suffer.
An indigenous person, the fur trade represents so much more to me than just animal abuse. It represents cultural genocide.
That is fully summarized. There were 6 or 8 in the raiding party.
It was racist, but we did not know about the terrible conditions.
These transactions are
going
to be more and more frequent.
Every laboratory brings us information from inside the lab, and someone who works there
who could have been
the animal's
brain. They found the animals stable and healthy. I able to use their arms and legs. No food or medical care.
Good day, everyone. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm. I'm your host for today, Rob Moore, here with Lamia Gibson. Lamia, how's the non-smoking thing going?
It's going pretty good. Still 4 weeks now, I guess.
4 weeks.
Yeah.
That's excellent. Let's give her a hand, everybody. You can also visit us at www.animalvoices.ca. You can find our email and archived shows there, as well as lots of information on our guests. So recently, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month this October, of course, and recently on the local Toronto news, there was a story on a woman who had a double mastectomy to prevent breast cancer because it ran in her family, and she did not want breast cancer, so she had both her breasts removed as a preventative measure. And this kind of scared me. I thought, is that the last resort? Is that what most women feel is a viable option of preventing breast cancer? Because being involved with the show and, you know, reading so much about vegetarian nutrition, I've read like little bits that actually nutrition alone can help prevent breast cancer. But I wasn't, you know, completely sure. I didn't know how concrete that evidence was. So on today's show, in honor of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we are going to talk about preventing breast cancer, among many other important life-changing, or rather life-saving tidbits, with T. Colin Campbell, Ph.D., from his book, The China Study, the Most Comprehensive Study of Nutrition Ever Conducted, and the Startling Implications for Diet, Weight Loss, and Long-Term Health. And really, it's the largest nutritional study, according to the book, ever done with humans in the history of biomedical research. And while I do disagree with some of the points in this book, I have to say that it is a book that everyone should have. If you do not own a copy of the China Study, go out and buy it. If you know someone who does not own a copy of it, go out and buy it for them. It's that important. Dr. Campbell has spent over 40 years in nutrition research and is the Jacob Gold Sherman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University and Project Director of the China-Oxford Cornell Diet and Health Project. And that is a mouthful. Dr. Campbell, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
First, I want to say that you're my favorite kind of guest to have on the show because I love people who have changed their minds and had the courage to admit it. And you said you were a dairy farmer and a, quote, establishment scientist in your book, and you even scoffed at vegetarians in your nutrition lectures. Could you talk about your views back then and what the turning point was for you?
Yes. I was a typical meat and potatoes kind of guy, I guess, as we say. Raised on the typical American diet, high in meat, dairy, and eggs, and so forth. And then when I went away to school, I actually did my doctoral dissertation on trying to figure out how to grow cows more efficiently so we could eat more of them and drink more of their milk. I mean, that was really my background. I was very much involved in that. And then when I got involved in research, a fairly substantial research program, I was, as you just indicated, a so-called establishment scientist in the sense that as far as nutrition is concerned, I thought then, and still many people today think the same thing, that nutrition is a function of the consumption of individual nutrients as we discover them, define them, and learn something about them. And so, you know, nutrition is just a straightforward kind of science where you study things in great detail, you know, what each individual nutrient does, and perhaps you can even take them as individual nutrients as supplements, for example. That's the way we thought then, and as I say, we still think today. I call it very reductionist in sort of view, or reductionist nutrition. And now I've come to realize over the years that that really is wrong. I mean, the body is a marvelous sort of, I don't even want to call it a machine because that's misleading, it's just a marvelous system by which, you know, hundreds of thousands of chemicals in food sort of operate together in a highly integrated manner to produce a sort of almost like symphony to produce their effects. And so it brings us back to nutrition being defined as food, not as individual nutrients. And when we sort of take that approach and we study the question of the relationship between, let's say, food and the various health and disease outcomes, we learn something, you know, far more than just examining individual nutrients. I mean, there's so many ways of looking at, let's say, food patterns as they relate to disease production. And it gives us answers that are much more convincing and much less contentious and controversial. And unfortunately, research has not done that way very much. I mean, there's some in the recent years, but not very much. And so when I take that approach, talking about nutrition in a more holistic way, you know, everything working together, within the food, all the chemicals working together in a sense, some sort of promoting disease, others inhibiting disease, if you will, that's where we really learn some really important things. And then taking that sort of same view, the holistic view, and extending it to larger issues, you know, not just about food, but also about exercise, about our environment, about, of course, an interest you have about, you know, even the violence in the world, you know, on all kinds of fronts. I mean, the story really becomes very, very big when we think in a holistic manner, as opposed to thinking about it in a highly reductionist manner. And thinking about it in a very reductionist way is almost the essence of science. And that's the essence of establishment science. So that's what I mean when I say that I sort of migrated, if you will, from establishment science, in a sense, the stuff that gets funded, the stuff that gets sold, the stuff that makes money. I graduated from that, or was graduation the right word, but I sort of changed my views over to this much more holistic view that has so much more information in it, so much more impressive information.
Perhaps you could say you evolved to that ideal.
Yes. Yeah, okay. We can say I evolved. I don't want to put too much value judgment on it.
Sure.
You know, other people might have other opinions, but at least for me, that's what really mattered, was looking at it in a larger context. You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, deciding what to eat really has major, major implications and consequences. You know, for our own health, for our society's health, you know, for all kinds of things.
So let's talk then, and we can discuss exactly what your findings were. Let's talk about the China study. You know, everybody talks about studies and new research and says, oh, you know, I heard a small study in Australia said this, and a small study in France proved that. How big is the China study, and why should we believe in it?
Well, it was big in this sense, not in terms of numbers of people, because there are much larger studies in terms of numbers of people, and so sometimes that's misunderstood. But in any case, it was a comprehensive study. It was a very comprehensive study, meaning that we had a large number of villages in China to study. And our example, altogether 130 villages. And then we sort of collected as much information as we could on factors that might, in fact, relate to the unusual cancer rates that we saw in some places in China. I mean, we measured lots of things, lots of different kinds of nutrients. Intakes and activities, and we measured hormones, we measured viruses, we measured, you know, poison chemicals, we measured all different kinds of disease outcomes. And so that's what I mean, you know, trying to get a more holistic view of things. We wanted to look for patterns, you know, as we put all this information together. We didn't particularly want to obviously focus too much on any individual nutrient or individual this or individual that, but rather look for the much more important and larger questions.
And then why specifically China? And it's actually specifically rural China that you focused on.
Right. Well, rural China was better than urban China because rural China is a place where we believed and subsequently proved that their residency is very stable. In other words, between 90 and 94% of the respondents in our survey, in our study, actually were born in the counties where they were living at the time we did the survey. So, in other words, they don't move around. They're very stable. For experimental purposes, that's very important. And also, at the same time, virtually all these people in those areas were consuming food that was locally produced. And so we had a very stable food consumption pattern, a very stable residency pattern. And yet we had differences in disease rates going from one county to another. So from an experimental point of view, this is nearly ideal. and unusual, I should say. And so compared to other studies, we, of course, did measure lots of different things, and that's also what made the study quite unusual and comprehensive, of course.
And so, and what was their diet consisting of?
Well, they were mostly consuming plant-based foods, and of course, stuff happens or is the low in total fat, very different from North American societies, of course. Also very high in dietary fiber, also different. In other words, they were consuming foods, mostly plant-based foods. Just to give you a sort of an idea of how different those diets were from, let's say, those consumed in the United States and Canada. In China, if you look, just sort of look at the proportion of the total protein intake from plants on one hand and animals on the other, that sort of gives us a good handle what I'm talking about. In China, just ranging across the different counties, the animal protein intake as a proportion of the total protein ranged from something like almost 0% to up something maybe like 20% of the total protein comes from animal foods. In the United States and Canada, it's more like 50% to 100%. In other words, we are more carnivorous in our two countries than we are herbivorous. About 70 to 75% of our total protein intake is from animal food, whereas in China, it's only one-tenth that. I mean, that was striking. In fact, I thought when we did the study, which was, of course, unusual in the sense of studying this kind of population, when we did the study, I didn't think we would see that much, really, because I thought, well, we're not consuming much in the way of animal foods. This is not going to make that much difference. We're not going to see associations with disease outcomes. When in reality, when we did the study and started looking at these relationships comprehensively, it was really quite striking. You know, even putting fairly small amounts of animal food in the diet, as it were, tends to relate to increasing risk of cancers and heart disease and, you know, the kind of diseases that kill most of us in North America before our time.
Okay, so for example, right now in the States, we've got, you know, heart disease and cancer and stroke as being, you know, among the top leading causes of death.
Right.
And then what did you find in rural China? Like, were those same diseases at all prevalent?
Well, heart disease was almost non-existent in many parts of China, which is really a striking thing. And that, in turn, was associated with far lower blood cholesterol levels. Their average cholesterol level is around 127 milligrams per deciliter, whereas the average here in the North America is more like 210, almost 100 points higher, 90 to 100 points higher. So they had much lower blood cholesterol levels, which in turn were associated with greater consumption of various plant materials. The lower levels were, that is. The higher the cholesterol levels in China, ranging from, let's say, from 90 up to 170, as that sort of went up that range, that was associated with the consumption of meat, dairy, and eggs, although there's not much dairy consumed except in a few regions. So, you know, when they started adding more animal foods, the areas that consume more animal foods, I should say, had somewhat higher cholesterol levels, although still low by our standards. That, in turn, is associated with the higher risk of heart disease and most cancers. But to go back to your original question, you know, so what did they die of? And everybody has to die of something. We have to be a little careful how we sort of make these kind of comparisons, because we have to compare death rates on an equivalent basis across different societies. So all of these so-called mortality rates are age-adjusted to account for the different age distribution between our societies. When we do this, what we find is that cancer and heart disease is much, much lower in China than here, when we take into consideration, you know, nutritional effects. But they do die in China, in rural areas, of the infectious diseases, like pneumonia, tuberculosis, you know, intestinal disorders and things like that, in large measure because they're public health conditions which tend to allow for parasitism and infectious diseases to occur. The public health conditions are not what they ought to be compared to the West, and so people are much more vulnerable to those kind of diseases. So that's what they're dying of. They're dying of the so-called diseases of poverty, as some people want to call it, and not so much the diseases of Western societies or diseases of affluence, as some people say.
And so, and I guess, what was the biggest finding that you discovered from this study?
I think the biggest finding, and any of these findings I'm going to mention, incidentally, should be considered in the context of what other kinds of research have been done. But nonetheless, the biggest finding was that small intakes of animal-based foods were associated with increasing levels of blood cholesterol, for example, and other factors, and increasing levels of heart disease and cancer. I think that was the most striking thing that I noticed. As I say, I didn't expect that, you know, relatively small intakes of animal-based foods would make so much difference, but in our China study, it did. And coming from the farm background that I came from and my professional sort of experiences too, that was striking. That was really striking, especially when considered in the context of other kinds of research that others were doing, and also in terms of the kind of research that we were doing in our own laboratory. And it finally convinced me that, you know, consuming a plant-based diet really was where it's at. I mean, that's where health is obtained. And having reached that particular point and saying, wait a minute, my own background wasn't quite what it ought to be, and I started looking around. I mean, it's a very provocative thing, if you will, in science. And so I started looking around at the work of others, and both contemporary work as well as work historically. And I started discovering some people who are doing amazing things, you know, with a plant-based diet, like, you know, reversing heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
Or reverse to some of the other advances. I mean, this kind of diet actually turns out now, on the basis of the evidence that we now have, this kind of diet, this plant-based diet, low in fat, I should add, too, this kind of diet actually can be used to treat disease, not just to prevent disease. It can be used to treat disease, which is a very exciting concept.
And you said in your book, just talking about heart disease again, you said over the next 24 hours, 3,000 Americans will have heart attacks, roughly the same number of people who perished in the terrorist attacks of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And that's astounding. 3,000 over the next 24 hours. And you're suggesting, or you found in the China study, that if we switch to a primarily plant-based or to a totally plant-based diet, that those could be prevented.
Yes, the vast majority of them could be prevented. That's true. I think that ought to make headlines and, you know, across our countries because of the size of the effect. I'd like to look at it also another way. I didn't put that in the book, but I'm inclined now to say, when I give my lectures, that the number one cause of death in North America, if you will, is ignoring nutrition. That's the number one cause of death. In other words, if we take the most conservative estimate of the amount of heart disease and cancer, diabetes, that could be prevented by, you know, eating the right kind of diet. We even take the most conservative estimates of our critics. In that case, if you just do the numbers, it turns out that clearly the number one cause of death is simply not eating the right food. I mean, it's far in excess of the other things. And then we'll put in second place heart disease, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not responsive to dietary change, although there's not much of that. Or cancers that are not responsive, you know, to dietary change.
Right.
So I think we need to start saying that. The number one cause of death is consuming the wrong food.
And it's true. I mean, this should be making the headlines around the world. And people who are listening, they might be thinking, oh, well, this is alternative radio. I'm hearing this information from an alternative media outlet. So why don't we hear this information on the front pages and at the, you know, top of the news reports?
Just comment. Incidentally, I've really gotten kind of disturbed with the use of this word alternative.
Yeah, me too, honest to God. But, you know, that's what we are considered by many people.
That's right. And that's a way to sideline our views or discard our views, even, by calling it alternative, like there's something strange, when in fact it ought to be mainstream. I mean, the other stuff ought to be alternative, you know, breaking open a person's chest and trying to change things around, you know, and mechanically change things around. To me, that sounds pretty alternative to me, you know, compared to what it ought to be. But in any case, you ask him, why haven't we heard this before? Well, I had almost 20 consecutive years working on expert panels in Washington and elsewhere, expert panels having to do with setting diet and health policy. And so I've seen how scientific information gets translated, if you will, into public information, or I would like to say how scientific information gets filtered, you know, to distill out stuff that, you know, is told to the public. And I have to tell you, I eventually came to be really alarmed about that whole process, that interface between science and policy, because that activity now is largely influenced by and even controlled by the food and drug industries, who don't want change. And there's various, perhaps subtle, but very powerful ways that can be done. You know, simply by choosing, you know, friends or consultants, hiding their association with the industry, put them on these panels, and then in turn coming up with recommendations for the public that really minimizes the kind of discussion we're having or minimizes the effect of a plant-based diet and, you know, promoting health and preventing disease.
So basically the industries can keep making money.
That's right. It is really all about, you know, what kind of message can create the most wealth, not the most health. It's all about making wealth, not health, and when it ought to be the other way around. I get really incensed about what I've come to learn, and I unfortunately become rather cynical of the system. And we need to, the public needs to know this.
And the thing is, I mean, the public is thinking, though, I mean, if this is true, if just simple nutrition could prevent 3,000 heart attacks in the next 24 hours, the government would not allow that information to stay under wraps. They would want us to know about it. My doctor would want me to know about it. Is it that they don't know, or is it that, you know, some of them don't want us to know?
Well, you know, I happen to believe in the goodness of people, you know, most people, quite frankly. I'm not so concerned about, you know, the individual motives of individuals, even professionals within our respective professional societies, as I am with the system within which we live. I think of this as a systemic problem. It's a system-wide problem, and, you know, unfortunately, we all contribute to this so-called wrong paradigm, both as consumers, as well as professionals, as well as policymakers, as well as voters. It's a huge problem. And what we need to do, and it seems to me in this case, is simply to air these views, make sure they're heard, because I'm really convinced that the vast majority of the public citizens, taxpayers, if you will, if they were to hear what evidence really is available and understand it, that would be a major grassroots movement. We could begin to cause change. And you're right, there is within the system this effort to try to suppress this information. And it occurs in large measure at the policy level that I'm so familiar with. It also occurs, I should say, too, at the level of, you know, providing research funds for doing the research in the first place. I've also sit on a number of these panels and had a lot to, you know, had been very much involved in deciding which kind of grant applications get funded, which ones don't. And there again, what we tend to fund is what I call reductionist research, the kind of research that would lead to yet another discovery of some drug or manipulation of some gene, rather than, you know, doing research, the kind of thing we're talking about, and so that we can better understand, you know, this more holistic effect of nutrition, you know, on health and prevention of disease.
And this kind of change can start with books like The China Study. We're going to take a short break from Animal Voices. We're going to have some ads, I think, and maybe some music. And you're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Just a short break. We're speaking today with Dr. T. Colin Campbell about nutrition and preventing disease. We're going to talk about preventing breast cancer and also prostate cancer as well. But before we get into that, I want to just ask a few general points that I think might be of interest to our listeners. First, I like how you talk in your book about science and about research and about how you do the research, and that this data is not absolute, that animal protein will not always, you know, lead to these kinds of diseases?
Yes, of course. I mean, in science, we have to remember we're talking about probabilities, not certainties, for the most part. So, you know, the kind of things that I say are, I would suggest, are highly probable, and that's indicated by the degrees of statistical significance, if you will, in many of these cases. But it's good enough for me if I realize that there's 9 chances out of 10 that I'm right, or 99 chances out of 100 that I'm right. That's good enough for me to make a decision, even though there's an occasional person that might slip through.
Right, yeah, the odds are. So about protein, I mean, many vegetarians worry about protein. You know, protein, protein, protein is kind of the buzzword of nutrition. And you differentiate between the quality of protein and the efficiency of protein. Could you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, there is a difference between plant-based proteins versus animal-based proteins in the efficiency with which they are utilized in the body. That is, the efficiency with which they get digested and absorbed and utilized to, let's say, create growth, if you will. And so there's that kind of difference. And animal proteins have conventionally been called over the years high-quality protein because of that, which unfortunately puts a bit of a smear on plant proteins when, in fact, it ought to be the other way around. And so animal proteins tend to promote things like, you know, as I say, growth, cell growth, body growth. And it does this in part through the increase in the production of growth factors. Namely, one is called insulin-like growth factor, for example, which in turn not only promotes growth of normal cells, it promotes growth of cancer cells, too. So as we look at the role of animal proteins and plant proteins and their relative effects, it turns out that animal proteins, for other reasons, also tend to create a somewhat more acidic environment in our cells, in our bodies, which in turn has an adverse effect on a number of different systems and reactions that can lead to, you know, loss of calcium, for example. It can lead to, you know, more autoimmune disease and higher cholesterol levels and so forth. So, you know, we do see these differences, but then this all has to be put in the context, incidentally, of the amount of protein that we need and the amount of protein we actually consume. The amount we need is about 10% of total calories, and that can all be plant protein. If, on the other hand, if we're only consuming 10% protein, some of it could be animal protein, perhaps it wouldn't make a big difference. But as soon as we go above 10%, and almost everybody does because they're so concerned about protein, as soon as we go above 10%, on up to 15, 20, 25%, you know, the total energy, that's when we get into problems, especially if that protein is animal-based. And it's not just because of the protein. It's also because of the other kinds of imbalances in nutrient intake that also occur when we're doing that. So the protein thing is central to my argument, the protein distinction, but it's not, as you said or indicated, it's not the only thing. It's you know, all the other imbalanced nutrient intakes that come along with it, which makes the story, quite frankly, in my view, even more powerful and impressive.
Mm-hmm. And for people who want more of the technical details on that, definitely pick up the book, The China Study. More on protein, you know, many vegetarians use soy as, you know, quite a staple to their diet in soy milk and these soy meat products. And in the past few years, a couple of studies, I don't know how reliable they are, have pointed to soy and linking soy to Alzheimer's and elevated estrogen levels. Could you please give us the final word on that, if you can?
Yeah, well, as I say, I can't give the final word.
No, but...
but anyhow, let me give you my impression. Yeah, some of these studies that are coming out on soy, particularly the consumption of, you know, rather high levels of soy, some of these studies are, you know, a little of some concern. And so I've arrived at the point of view that, both for theoretical and I think for empirical reasons, that we probably consume too much soy. And we ought to be somewhat careful. If we're consuming, you know, just plant-based foods, whole plant-based foods, I should say, you know, whole fruits, whole vegetables, whole grains, that sort of thing, we're getting enough protein to start with. That's going to run around 10, 12% or so, with, you know, with a good varied diet. So we don't actually need any soy, to be honest about it. People tend to think they ought to be consuming that because, allegedly, you know, some real benefits there.
And it's a complete protein, they say.
Well, it's not a complete protein. Soy protein is not a complete protein.
It's not a complete protein.
No, the word complete means, you know, that all the amino acids are there in the right ratio that we need them when we, you know, synthesize our own protein.
Right.
That's not quite true. Soy protein is a little bit deficient in the sulfur amino acids. But setting that aside, it's not so much a question of whether it's complete or not complete. If you're consuming a variety of different protein sources collectively, it's going to be essentially complete, so you don't need to worry about that.
What does that mean, though, in terms of just plants? Like, I don't think people understand that there's protein in plants. Like in lettuce. Like you say, eat a variety of plant foods to get your protein sources. Oh, what does that translate into?
Well, proteins, of course, are big molecules made up of, 10, 15, maybe even 20 different amino acids that are all hooked together in a chain, so to speak. And so when we consume these proteins, we digest them down to our individual amino acids, absorb them, plant proteins, when they're broken down to the individual amino acids, usually a little bit low in one or two or so, and then resynthesized, the whole process of resynthesizing our protein from plant proteins is slowed down, essentially. That's why they're called incomplete. But that's a kind of a moot point, to be honest about it, because we actually consume plants from varied sources, varied kinds of plants. And so whereas one plant protein may be a little bit low in lysine, one of the amino acids, another one might be a little bit low in methionine. You know, if you put them all together, those so-called relative deficiencies all smooth out, and it makes no difference. So the whole discussion about, you know, whether it's complete or incomplete is now of more historical significance than practical significance. We just don't need to worry about it. We just combine proteins, combine foods, I should say, you know, from different sources. It's one of the reasons for combining foods like this in a, you know, having a varied diet, not only for the purpose of making sure we get a, you know, a balanced protein intake, but also in order to ensure that we're getting enough of the antioxidants and dietary fibers and, you know, the right kinds of fats and so forth.
Right. All right. Well, you know, Dr. Campbell, you're on Animal Voices, and we've discussed animal experimentation in the past quite a lot on this show, including, you know, we've talked about non-animal rightists, scientists specifically, who are coming out against it, you know, because of the implications that the animal experiments are not only unreliable for humans, but even dangerous for humans. Yet you defend your use of animal studies. Could you explain that?
Yeah, very interesting. I certainly did, in fact, in the early part of my career, use a lot of animal studies to learn something about, you know, how things work. And ironically, my views on protein actually came from animal studies, the kind of studies that, unfortunately, I don't believe really could have been done in humans. And so they were a step on my path that gave us some information, extremely valuable information, I would argue. And I know this is a very sensitive topic, talking about, you know, experimental animal studies, if you will, and I'm very sensitive to that, and I do understand the concerns about that. I share many of the concerns of, you know, the animal rights communities on this, especially in the way animals are treated on farms, I should point out. I came from a farm, but at the same time, there's a bigger question here that we should not lose sight of, and that is that we should talk about, it seems to me, violence in a larger context. You know, violence against our bodies, violence against the environment, violence against other sentient beings, violence against each other, you know, all in the name of consuming the wrong food. And, you know, if we start consuming the right kind of food, and we have enough information right now to actually make this case without, you know, doing experimental animal research, and we do it that way, we'll make great gains. One of the problems with some of my critics, especially in the animal rights groups, one of the problems is that when they label me or they tell me, you know, not to talk about this, they're taking away some of the most important lessons I learned that, in fact, is to their benefit or to our benefit, I should say. And if I'm, you know, accused, as I have been, of being having an animal rights agenda by my critics in the traditional scientific communities, and that certainly has been the case, that diminishes what I'm saying. So what I'm suggesting, both for any community, whether it's, you know, communities that are avidly interested in animal rights or whether it's community interested in traditional science or drugs, whatever, and we all ought to put our heads together and say, you know, ask some larger questions here, you know, about what does nutrition really mean? You know, it means a lot to health. It means a lot to our society. It means a lot to our environment. And, you know, think about it in that context and maybe reduce some of the shouting and yelling at each other about this kind of thing. So that's where I come from, and I'm very much, you know, aware and sensitive, and I share those sentiments myself.
And what about, though, like the supposed danger of these kinds of studies? For example, and this may be completely wrong because I can't back this up, I don't remember where I read it, but that the nutritional requirement, or, you know, what is tended to be touted as the nutritional requirement for humans, the 40-30-30, 40% carbohydrates, 30% fats, and 30% protein, were based on studies with rats or mice, because that provided the optimal growth. But we know that 30% protein is dangerous for humans. First of all, was that true, that came from those kinds of studies?
No, those studies did not. That's basically a misrepresentation. That claim that, you know, 40-30-30 thing came along mostly from physicians who have no training in nutrition and who are basically wanting to tell people good things about their bad habits. I mean, it sold books. That's what it did. And, you know, they were making these unsubstantiated claims, dangerous claims, that really didn't come from experimental. Besides, I should tell you that the amount of protein, for example, that rats require percentage-wise, the percent of calories, is virtually the same as humans.
Hmm.
So, you know, it couldn't possibly come from rats, and whoever says that is simply wrong. They don't understand nutrition.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's floating around out there. And that's why, like, I'm glad to have you on, because you're not necessarily animal rightist, and you don't have that, you don't come with that bias. You sort of came at it from a different perspective. And even though many will disagree with your use of animal experiments, and I disagree with your use of animal experiments, and am not yet convinced that you could not derive the same conclusions specifically from your human trials, I think that what you have to say is still valid. And we have to listen to that side of the argument. Otherwise, you know, without dialogue, we're not going to get anywhere.
So, I'm glad to say, have you say that. You know, we need dialogue. That's
yes.
What I say. We need dialogue.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, human studies, and I know what you said, you disagree with this. My question that I put to my friends, you know, were evidentialists and right, what kind of studies can be done in humans to show, in fact, what we actually learned? I don't know. Dr. Michael Clapper, who I have great admiration for, and Dr. Neil Barnard, I put those questions to them, you know, and we can't come up with a. I mean, you see what this did, those studies that we did, it certainly converted me, or really got me thinking seriously. Changed my lifestyle and everything else, and quite frankly, as I give the lectures, that an awful lot of people say, that's it for me, you know, when they hear those kind of studies, and they're changing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that, and I know it doesn't sit well with people who don't want to ever hear that kind of thing, but it's a simple fact. We just kind of have to live with an uncomfortable fact, I think.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a kind of a sort of a big argument, big debate, because, I mean, like, you know, bigger than the concept of the nutritional implications of eating animals is the perception that animals are there for us to eat. And that perception and our belief in that perception is kind of what got us here in the first place.
I agree with that. We don't need to eat them. I come to the same place. But
yeah, right.
Yeah, because of the empirical data that we actually got, and I'm so convinced of it.
Okay, so let's move on to finally breast cancer. You know, I said at the beginning of the show I wanted to do this because women are thinking that a mastectomy, a double mastectomy, is a good preventative measure if they have a family history of breast cancer to prevent getting breast cancer themselves. And I even read in your book a woman asked you about having her daughter get a double mastectomy. So that's pretty scary. First of all, how many women in the U.S. will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year?
Oh, gosh, I don't know what the number is.
Well, I think you said 500,000 will be diagnosed with breast and prostate and colorectal, I think.
Yeah, collectively.
Collectively.
Yeah, you know, something like that.
First, how are drugs and screening as preventative measures? You know, many doctors advocate drugs and screening. What do those have to offer?
I don't think they have much to offer, to be honest about it. I mean, screening sounds okay, but, you know, there's a bit of a difficulty in that because what we're really doing is perhaps discovering something that looks troublesome a little bit earlier, but it doesn't change the course of the disease, essentially. So it leads to some mischievous figures. I mean, I'm not advocating against screening. It, you know, kind of alerts people a wake-up call if they see something, so that's worthwhile. And they ought to be changing their diet. As far as drugs are concerned, you know, there's some evidence that tamoxifen in particular can reduce the risk of breast cancer a little bit, slow it down. Some of that work was done at the University of Oxford in particular, and it's kind of convincing, you know, as far as the effect is concerned. Not a large effect, I don't think, but the main point is that all of this can be, there's also side effects from tamoxifen, by the way. That's the worrisome. Even if we admit that there's some little benefit, there's always a side effect we have to worry about. Well, my point is that if we understand what diet is doing in this case, why not use diet to control this disease?
That's the thing. How important is genetics in determining a woman's chance of getting breast cancer?
Well, you know, for a small percentage of women, and it's really quite small, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% or something in that neighborhood, there are these really pretty serious genes, BRCA1, BRCA2, if you will, that seem to really raise the risk for some individuals pretty high. In other words, the bar, raising the bar is a quite high level, not only for breast cancer, but also for ovarian cancer, too. And so, you know, in those kind of cases, my view is that there's still hope. People are not necessarily going to get those cancers just because they have those genes. They can sort of largely keep it under control. at least delay its appearance substantially by consuming the right kind of diet. They just have to be quite rigorous about, you know, what they're doing. But in the larger context, talking about all the rest of the women, the other 95% or so, really diet now has been shown to have a very important relationship to the emergence of breast cancer, and also being shown to, you know, be able to delay its appearance. And so I think this is a very important point. I have a paper just in front of me right now, it's just published this year, showing a very impressive relationship between milk consumption, for example, and breast cancer, if you compare different societies. The same thing is also true for ovarian cancer and uterine cancer. I mean, the dairy relationship with these three cancers, ovaries, uterus, and breast, as well as prostate, of course, for men, I mean, it's really, really impressive. And now we're learning quite a bit about, you know, the sort of the fundamental biochemistry of this whole relationship. As I said before, dairy in particular tends to turn on the synthesis of these growth hormones, like insulin-like growth factor, and tends to increase, in the case of women, their circulating levels of estrogen, which tend to promote the development of cancer. And so, you know, the noose is tightening, you know, as far as this hypothesis is concerned about dairy and these kind of diseases. But it really, we have, if there was any other food showing these kind of relationships with breast cancer, it would make headlines across the world.
And could you talk also about the details of, you mentioned in your book how the elevated estrogen levels will lead, you know, girls, young girls, to be getting their menarche. Is that how it's pronounced? Menarche?
Menarche.
And that will also, that increased exposure to the estrogen can lead to early breast cancer. Is that correct?
Yeah, it turns out much of this information we actually got in our China study, although supported by, you know, many other different kinds of studies too. Basically, what we learned was that, well, we knew this from before, but we just reconfirmed the idea that is, the earlier the age of menarche, the greater the risk for breast cancer. And in Western societies, we have an early age menarche, so they have higher breast cancer risk. Age of menarche here is, what, 10, 11, 12 years of age or so. Whereas in China, the average is around 17 years. I mean, there's a delayed onset of the menses in rural Chinese women. And first, so they have a much lower risk of breast cancer. Secondly, in China, the Chinese women, they reach menopause earlier, about 3 or 4 years earlier than Western women. So all told, the Chinese woman is experiencing about 8 or 9 less years of reproductive life than is the case for Western women. That's one point. And then during those years, reproductive years, we all know the estrogen levels kind of surge. They remain pretty high. I mean, they go up and down over the monthly cycle, but they basically remain quite high during those reproductive years compared to, let's say, or they're much higher in Western women, about 50% higher than, let's say, in rural Chinese women. And so we got two things going on here as far as breast cancer in the West is concerned, and this estrogen story is concerned. First off, Western women have about 8 to 9 years longer reproductive life. Secondly, to exacerbate the problem, they have estrogen levels that are about 50% higher during those reproductive years. So their total exposure to estrogen, considering both time and concentration, their total exposure to estrogen is about 4 to 5 times greater than rural China. And similarly, the risk of getting breast cancer is about 4 to 5 times higher. And we know now that, you know, circulating estrogen levels, especially prolonged exposure to high estrogen levels, that's a problem. And it's associated with breast cancer. And that's quite clear. And incidentally, age of menarche, this can come back to food and diet again. Age of menarche is influenced by the rate at which a child grows. That is, the faster they grow, the harder we push them to grow fast, the earlier the age of menarche. And we can do that by feeding dairy and meat. So as we're feeding animal-based foods, we're really promoting the growth of children, you know, to their maximum, if you will. They reach reproductive years earlier. That's not good. In the end, if they keep on that diet, of course, which most people do, they end up with higher levels of estrogen, so they're just putting themselves right in harm's way for many years to come.
Right, and most people think that a fast-growing child is a sign of health.
That's right, and exactly. Now we're learning that's not really true. But there's one thing about feeding. Let's say, this leads to another question I thought you might be asking. Namely, you know, what about children consuming a plant-based diet from day zero onward? I mean, is their growth impaired? A lot of people previously had thought that might be true, that vegan children are going to be smaller and weaker and so forth and so on. That's not really true. If they're consuming a varied diet, you know, plenty of food, you know, vegetables, fruits, grains, they grow almost as fast. They're imperceptibly slower growth, but it's not a big deal because at the time they reach adulthood, they will reach their genetic potential just as well as people who do otherwise. They just grow a little more slowly. And it's interesting that vegan children, if you will, they tend to continue to add a little bit more height right on up until they're 18, 19, 20 years of age. Whereas, you know, the ones that are growing so fast, they reach it a little bit earlier. That's a problem.
Right. And for women who are listening, you're saying that, you know, if you avoid meat and dairy, you'll also tend to avoid breast cancer. But for a lot of women, meat and dairy mean calcium and iron, which are two big concerns for women. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, we've been sold on the idea, usually sold by the dairy industry and their apologists and enthusiasts. We've been sold on the idea we should be consuming a high calcium diet for, you know, building strong bones and teeth, as the story goes. In reality, societies that consume the most calcium have the highest rates of osteoporosis. Societies that consume the most animal protein also have the highest rates for osteoporosis. And so we get our extra calcium and extra protein primarily from dairy. So societies that consume the most dairy, you know, have the most osteoporosis. Exactly the opposite of what the dairy industry has told us for so long. And we know a lot about how that works, too. The high calcium diet, you know, sounds like it's a good idea. It makes denser bones and all that kind of thing. But when people are consuming these high calcium diets, you know, for much of their life, what that happens is they become accustomed to that. Their body adjusts to that to some extent. And finally, when they come to menopause and they lose, you know, this high concentration of estrogen and it comes down rather rapidly, there is some risk, you know, for osteoporosis at that point. And whereas if they had been consuming a plant-based diet somewhat lower in calcium during the formative years and during the reproductive years and kept at it that way, then when they reach menopause, their bodies are much better conditioned, much better able, you know, to handle the changes that naturally occur during menopause. And thus, there are lower risk for osteoporosis.
And what about iron? Where can women get their iron from in a plant-based diet?
Interestingly, in rural China, you know, we thought, in fact, that there would be, you know, iron deficiency, if you will. So we measured iron status in six different ways. And we really went after this one to get as much information as we could on it. And it turned out that, first off, when consuming all those plant-based foods, they were actually consuming more iron than we do here in North America, but twice as much. And their iron indicators were all very good, thank you,
yeah.
At least for adults. And we didn't see any particular problems. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there's no iron deficiency problems in a place like rural China. There are. In fact, it's quite serious in some places, even for children, maybe for pregnant women. But that's largely attributed, in my view at least, and to the views of many others, it's attributed to the prevalence of parasitic diseases. You know, if you got a lot of parasitism, intestinal parasites around, they kind of suck the blood out of you, if you will. So that's one of the reasons there's so much iron deficiency. And unfortunately, over the years, we've been told by some people that, you know, all that anemia that we tend to see in these rural countries and in these foreign countries or poor countries, all this anemia is due to the fact we're not getting enough meat, if you will.
Mm-hmm. We only have a couple minutes left. I want you to take a minute and talk also about prostate and colorectal cancer, because I guess the dietary indications can be the same.
Yes. One of the amazing things that I think we've run across in this whole thing is that this diet suits you know, all kinds of people and a variety of conditions and prevents all kinds of diseases, including prostate cancer and colon cancer. I mean, we have enough information on both of those cancers that it's virtually the same as we have for breast cancer, uterine cancer, and ovarian cancer, and other cancers. We could get into some details, but we don't really have time on that. But just rest assured that, you know, the kind of diet that prevents the cancers we have talked about also apply to prostate cancer and colon cancer. The relationship with dairy is particularly strong for prostate cancer. And this is actually dairy that is the skim milk, the non-fat, low-fat kind of dairy. because it still has very high concentration of protein. And so that's a concern. That's really a concern.
Definitely. And in the book, you also talk about, you know, various diseases, diabetes and all kinds of diseases. I just wanted to make one more point. In the book, you say synthetic chemicals in the environment and in your food, as problematic as they may be, are not the main cause of cancer. A lot of people think, well, those are the main causes of cancer, pesticides and herbicides and everything else that's floating around in our environment. What is the case? What did you find on that?
Well, you know, they are worrisome, and I worry about them too. I mean, those kind of chemicals whose biological activities are relatively unknown. I mean, we're using they're spread around far and wide far too much in our food and so forth and so on. My only point about that comment was that we don't have really the kind of empirical data to show that, in fact, the cancer rates that we do get are attributed to those chemicals. And so for us to continue to try to make that point, we're ignoring the role of just whole food itself. And so if we continue to make that kind of argument, we're going to get into trouble. And that's not to diminish, you know, the worry about and concern about those chemicals. We always try to avoid them, to be honest about it. But we can get cancer without those chemicals just by consuming the wrong kind of food.
Right. And if you could just say one last statement on what you want most everyone to know most from your research.
Well, I want to know that the information that people get from their governments has been filtered. You know, the scientific information that is actually available, the public is not knowing because it's been filtered by these committees, and I know that firsthand. And so the information that is put out there is basically trying to maintain the status quo of us eating the wrong food and, of course, getting diseases to go along with it. Perhaps even to support the use of more drugs to try to reverse these diseases. So I want more dialogue.
More dialogue.
And yeah, more
information out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you talk a great deal also about the industry, how the information is kept from us. And it's also a great read, part biography, part scientific analysis, and just a lot of great knowledge. So I think that, you know, this kind of book can help to change North America for the better. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
For more information, please visit our website, www.animalvoices.ca. We've been speaking with Dr. T. Colin Campbell on his book, The China Study. Let me see what the full title is. The most comprehensive study of nutrition ever conducted and the startling implications for diet, weight loss, and long-term health. Get it today. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Roadrunner.